This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Greetings and welcome to Animal Instinct here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Celia Kutcher. I'm also known as the Food Healer, and I am recovering from a very long weekend, but a wonderful one. I want to give a shout out to Gratitude Migration. You guys are fantastic. Had a great time. This is why my voice sounds like it does. But on another note, I am interviewing artist Carrie Hovey today, sculptor. And so we're going to talk about her work and talk about the concepts of animals in her art. And I'm really excited, so we're just going to get started. Carrie, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Celia.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really excited to start this dialogue and this conversation. So is it okay with you if we just, like, do it?
Let's just jump in.
Perfect. Okay, for people that don't know who are you and what do you do?
My name is Carrie Hovey, as you've already said, and I primarily work in sculpture and installation.
And how long have you been sculpting?
Oh, gosh. I left my commercial design work in 2001 and went to get my MFA at San Francisco State. And ever since, I've been pursuing art.
Cool. And what materials do you use? Do you work in specifically one?
No. I pretty much work in everything and anything.
Cool.
I'm totally not medium specific. It's always the first question people ask.
Funny.
But, I have a complex answer for it. But when I say I'm not medium specific, for an example, I once had a residency at Recology, and only people on the West Coast will probably know that brand name, but it's basically the resource management company for the city of San Francisco.
Oh, cool.
But everyone else kind of calls it the dump. All the art we made while in residence, which was 4 months, had to come out of the public disposal.
Oh, wow.
So when I say that I'll really work with anything, I really do work with anything.
That's really cool. I love that concept. That's, wow.
Yeah. So I guess it goes more to my medium selection has to do with conceptualizing the project and then determining what materials best solve the problem I'm trying to solve.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Totally.
So, definitely, I will work with anything.
That's very cool. And so I know that, I mean, I've known your career since forever. I mean, Carrie and I went to art school together, and so we've known each other before. We were, like, doing, you know, we were making tons of art and stuff, but just for grades. And Carrie's one of the few friends I have, an artist that has really gone on to have a successful career. And you've always been super, super smart, which is why I wanted to have this conversation with you.
Well, thank you.
I know, right?
But I want to say that you also had a recycling thing in your past with
totally.
That Hugo piano you made.
Totally. I mean, I think
it's still the one I talk about when I talk about that show.
Oh, thanks. I always think about your mailbox, too. If any of you are bored and want to know what in the hell we're talking about, do a Google search for Hugo Next, the car Hugo. So it's Y-U-G-O-N-E-X-T. And this is an art exhibit that Carrie and I were both in a million years ago. It was super fun. But so we've been making art out of stuff that can't be used for, oh my God, since the 90s, basically. And so, I mean, you're on the show because I know a lot of your work is animal imagery. Why do you use that? Why is that?
I think that it has to do with animals are an easy topic for people. We all have an association with animals. We all have warm feelings about animals.
Yeah.
We're empathetic to animals. They just hold kind of a magical place for us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think using animals allows me to be able to talk about other issues
mm-hmm.
in a way that people might be more receptive to.
Cool.
Rather than, it's a softer way to deal with difficult topics for me.
Cool.
That, and I'm fascinated by them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, needless to say, me too. It's and the more I'm doing this show, the more I'm realizing like how much we have in common and how much just in all different levels in terms of even like societal levels, you know, like animals really are very, very organized. Like each one, like a herd of elephants, for example, like they all have jobs, you know, and people all have jobs and everybody's got jobs on this planet. And it's kind of what keeps us going.
And they all cohabitate together so well.
We try. I mean, you know, they're better at it than we are. That's for damn sure.
Exactly.
And so when you like, when you, I don't even know, do you make a piece and then look for somewhere to show it? Or do you get gigs where they want you to make a piece and show it in their specific space? Like, how does it work for you?
There's a little bit of both. I'll generally write proposals if I want to make a piece for a specific place.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll research the place, look for connections. I travel a lot to produce my work.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll research where I'm going, what issues are relevant, what animal population is there, and then I'll write proposals based upon that.
Mm-hmm.
For myself, I will just make work that
yeah.
I feel compelled to make
yeah.
and then look for a place for it to be.
Cool.
I think a lot of curators prefer to work that way, to
uh-huh.
like rather than, oh, I have this huge vision of what this could be.
Yeah.
I think I've proven myself over time that I always deliver, but sometimes my projects have a tendency to be rather ambitious, and people are kind of like, sure, you're going to pull that off. So sometimes you do need to actually produce the work and have a curator see how it'll fit into their vision of their exhibition.
Totally. And I'm only laughing because Carrie was one of the most motivated artists that at SVA. And I mean, it was always like, you really think you can do that in 2 weeks? You really think you can do that in a month? And I mean, you did every time. And, you know, as we all know, when it comes to the art world and the fine art world, like we really have to have our act together and, you know, make deadlines and have them done and have them complete and all that. Because, you know, a lot of people think artists are pretty flaky. And just don't understand the amount of work that goes into one of these things, too. You know, your work is incredibly complex, and I mean, a lot of it's very large scale. It's got to take weeks to do this stuff, if not months or years.
Oh, gosh. Much longer than that for some projects.
Yeah.
But others, I mean, if you know the process that you're working with, I think with my work and that I spend so much time finding the right materials and the right processes
mm-hmm.
that I have a ramp up time on a lot of projects
mm.
because I'm learning the process as I go.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of experimentation early on before I nail down exactly what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then the projects typically deal with it or involve a lot of repetition. So once I get my factory line kind of set up,
yeah.
I'm good to go. But that initial onboarding, I guess, would be what takes the time.
Yeah, totally. And so, like, you know, you've got all these sculptures that are really beautiful and different kinds of animals and things like that. What kind of concepts does your work address?
Well, with the animals, recently I've been dealing with issues of poaching
mm-hmm.
And climate change, and how animals are being affected by climate change.
Mm.
I think those are the two most prevalent of the themes in my work as far as the animal work goes.
Mm-hmm. And so, like, we were talking about this prior to the show, and you were telling me about a piece that you did about an elephant. Can you talk about that a little bit? It was fascinating.
That one I hold dear to my heart. Some projects kind of come and go, and mm-hmm. others stick with you for quite some time. That's one of those that'll probably stick with me for quite a while.
Oh, cool.
I was at the Bag Factory, which is an artist residency in Johannesburg in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And this actually ends up leading into a project that we've also talked about, which I'll get to.
Oh, cool.
The work is called White Elephant and Elephant in the Room, and I'm kind of playing with those idiomatic phrases of a white elephant and then the elephant in the room that no one's talking about.
Yeah.
So that's what the piece was titled. And for that particular piece, I worked with wool, belted wool. So I was very specific in wanting to use sustainable material that came from animal to create the animal, because so much of the underground economy in Africa deals with the poaching of animals. And if those economic stresses didn't exist, there would be less poaching.
Yeah.
So I wanted to use a product or material that could contribute rather than take away. And since elephants are one of the major targets of the poaching industry, I wanted to come up with something that I could make the elephant out of that involved animals.
So yeah.
Wool specifically, though, the wool felting process involves a lot of labor, and it involves actually a lot of friction and agitation to make the wool and compression. And I thought that worked into the concept that I was dealing with.
Totally.
The piece that if we provided the... if we could remove the friction of in the economics of the situation through providing labor, then we would create a whole other industry.
Wow.
Were you going to say something? I'm sorry.
No, I'm just sitting here saying wow, because it's really the truth.
When I'm talking, I can't necessarily hear at the same time. So the wool industry specifically I targeted because it creates a series of jobs. It's not just the one job of the poacher going out and killing an animal. It supports a farming industry. It supports the groom, the people that shear the sheep, is process the wool, manufacture the roving, create the products from it. So you're creating a series of jobs.
Yeah.
And when those jobs go into the towns and the townships, it... the money stays within the community. So then you're creating other jobs because you're supporting local artisans. You're supporting the people that make clothing.
Totally.
So I think by just the materials an artist selects can have this ripple effect. And I was hoping that would read through the program, the project.
And so is this something that you put in your artist statement, or is this something that you're just kind of hoping that with people that, you know what they're looking at or really take the time to look at will come up with this on their own?
It depends how much wall text I think I can get away with reading.
Fair enough.
that particular project also linked into the idea of captivity and art. Well, the only way we keep these sapient beings alive is by imprisoning them, which I also overlapped with the politics of South Africa and the imprisonment of Mandela.
Wow.
And how he was held on Robben Island for so long. The materials also linked to that. Like, I painted the floor of the room the same color as his cell. The prisoners there were given two wool mats that were about an inch thick, and that's about the weight of the felt that I ended up making my elephant out of. So I try to create as much text and as many links that people could make into the content of the work. So, like I said, that one will stay close to my heart for
a
while.
I love your attention to detail. I mean, it's really just... it's for me, that's what art is really all about in many, many cases, you know, and just like the amount of thought that goes into a piece. And it's not like, oh, look, it's a bird. Like, you've got a whole, there's a whole reason why it's a bird, or, you know, and why it's that bird and what it's made out of and all that. And it just, it kind of really raises the dialogue a great deal. And it's funny, too, because if you'd done the elephant piece but had made it a human being, you know, it may have been read the wrong way. People may have just, the reactions would have been so different, you know? So it's really interesting to see that as well. How do you think that people react to, I know you haven't done all animal-based work, so what do you think the difference is in people's reactions regarding animal-based and non-animal-based art?
Well, I think for my work, most of my work either deals with animal issues or the environment. Mm-hmm. So I think the vast majority of people just kind of group my work together.
Yeah.
Under kind of environmental consciousness.
Yeah.
That said, I think the animals give the non-art community something that they can understand and grasp onto.
Mm-hmm.
Not to downplay or try to intellectualize art in any way, but a lot of art can sometimes be lack tangibility,
yeah,
or points of access that,
yeah,
you don't, unless you know the whole background and the whole dialogue and everything in the artist's statement and the wall text, you might not be able to get anything out of the work.
True.
If you don't have that background. I want my parents to look at it and be like, I get it.
Yeah.
Or I get something from it. I want people that aren't part of the arts world to still enjoy my work,
mm-hmm,
and be able to see it and respond to it.
You know, it's a really good point, because I think that in terms of like controversial subjects and stuff, when there's an image of a human involved, I know for myself, I mean, I'm getting better about it, but I tend to, my first reaction is always to shut down or to, you know, look over there, something shiny, you know, where if it's an animal, I'm kind of like, ooh, what's that? And then I can handle the concept fine, you know, and all that kind of stuff. It's the ASPCA commercials that kill me every time. But it's
right.
Like, you know, the ability to be like, oh, look, what's that? And then actually get more and more information out of it over, you know, a sculpture of, you know, some human that's a victim or is dying or is dead or has been abused horribly and all that. I think that in this day and age, there's so much of that that's out and that's prevalent in the news that I know a lot of people shut down when they hear that. So I think it's also a really nice doorway for dialogue for people that may not be willing to discuss that, but in that
right.
package, it seems like, oh, okay, it's a bunny, you know, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
And so we need to take a quick commercial break, so I want to do this and get this out of the way. We are talking to sculptor Carrie Hovey. Be back in about a minute and a half, so stay tuned.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledge the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Hi, I'm Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past here on Heritage Radio Network. Using food as a lens to observe history and culture, I take you on a weekly journey through different topics of culinary history. Tune in on Thursdays at noon to hear about the history of such topics as American cake, the accidental churning of butter, pho, the Vietnamese soup craze, and so much more. And help us keep this and other heritage programming alive. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate and continue enjoying great programs.
And we are back. I'm talking to Carrie Hovey all about her animal-based art. Carrie, question for you. I wanted to talk a little bit about anthropomorphism, because you're so many artists, including myself, I'm so guilty of this, is, you know, using animals in art and, you know, like a bunch of dogs around a table playing poker, for example,
right.
You know, things like that. I really, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I kind of feel like the work that you've done really doesn't do that at all. I feel like the animals that you're using are because they're animals and not, you know, to like the concept may represent something that humans are doing, but like what you're seeing is really like animals doing what they do.
I would agree with that. I believe that I allow them to be the animal that they are,
mm-hmm.
and that I don't try to make them human in any way.
Yeah.
You do see that in art, though.
All the time.
Quite frequently.
All the time.
Around the poker table if one wants to consider that art.
It's the classic, you know. It's one of the finest pieces in art history. But so many things do that. And I think a big part of that, too, is, you know, like illustration and, you know, which is another form of art. But so many illustrations are like, you know, a dog drinking a beer or, you know, whatever it may be, a cat driving a car, you know. And so I think when those are all fine and dandy. And like I said, I'm guilty of doing this too. But I think when you're talking about really high, deep concept art and, you know, true art, not just, you know, folk art or play art, but like really true conceptual art, I don't know if anthropomorphism really has a place in that. I mean, obviously there are people that have done it right. But right. I like the fact that you respect the animals and really represent them as the beings that they are. And they don't need a tuxedo or a top hat or something like that, you know?
Thankfully not. That would make me sad, actually. Why would I want them to be like us?
Yeah, right.
And take on our characteristics. We should be taking on their characteristics. I mean, I'm not naive enough to think that all's happy in the animal world. I mean, they eat one another.
Yeah.
But in general, they know how to coexist. Mm-hmm. They know how to work as a society. They all make it to the water hole. They all drink from the water hole. They all suffer when there's mm-hmm. no water hole.
Mm-hmm.
We could learn from them.
Well, and the craziest thing in the world, too, is like these watering holes. Like in many cases, I'm not going to say this is a blanket statement because I don't know that. But I mean, I've seen tons of photographs of animals that are enemies drinking next to each other at the water hole because this is kind of like a timeout. Like this does, you know, everyone behaves at the water hole, that kind of thing.
We all need to be here to survive.
Totally. Totally. So it's not even like we kill to kill. I mean, I know there are certain animals that do kill just to kill. But in most cases, it's like, no, we kill for food. And, you know, we take this very seriously and we kill what we need, which is so, I mean, we all need to learn this, you know, even in terms of just usage of stuff.
I don't think many animals kill to kill. I think it's always for a motivated reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's as a means of protection, someone will correct me, I'm sure. But it's, for the vast majority of the time, it's because of food or protection or protecting a baby. There's no just random willy-nilly, let's just let loose and go take out the impalas.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember reading something. I don't remember. I want to say it was like a weasel or some ferret or something like that, that like occasionally will go on kind of like a killing spree. But I mean, besides that, I am not aware of anybody else really doing that. And for that matter, I'm not really aware if, to be straight up, I someone told me this. I don't know if it's a fact or not. So they could have been wrong. You know, I could be believing in correct news. But it's like, you know, it's so funny because in the human world, if someone misbehaves or is acting, you know, uncivilized, we call them animals. And it's kind of like animals are so much more civilized than we are in so many cases.
In many ways, yes.
So many ways. It's crazy. So a lot of your pieces have a real ethereal feel to them. I really think that they're absolutely beautiful. Is this intentional? And why is, if so, why?
Oh, yeah. My work does have a tendency to take on an ethereal quality that's almost dreamlike or imaginary. It is purposeful. I never set out to make beautiful work.
Mm-hmm.
That's not one of the goals. But there's just so much beauty. How can you not?
Yeah.
You're working with beautiful animals or plants or spaces. It just by nature, I think we mimic that.
Mm-hmm.
So there is kind of an otherworldly quality to some of my work.
Yeah.
I think you might specifically be referencing the piece with the three white deer.
Yep, the deer and also the elephant I found really, really haunting and really, really beautiful and just kind of its own little, like, magical thing.
I think white contributes to that, the color white, and that it's a natural white. It's never a pure white, but it's like that warm white that you can, that just feels comfortable.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say that it feels light and kind of really, gosh, I don't know. I can't really put it into words.
Mm-hmm.
They're never a true representation. They've always got a mutation, and mutations generally perceived as a negative, but something that makes them a little bit magical and almost real, but not quite.
Yep.
That they've transformed into something that's not real, but we still have all the association of it being real.
Mm-hmm.
The deer have these magically long legs that kind of intertwine with one another and become a root system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like they're trying to ground themselves and find themselves a place to be when they don't really have anywhere to be anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's in a number of my pieces, I think there's a degree of displacement of something being plucked out of its environment and needing to find a new place to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like for the elephant, its environment is going away. We're encroaching upon it. Whether you believe or not, global warming is happening.
Yeah, totally.
And they're... water supplies are drying up, they're losing terrain, they're losing vegetation. They need a new place to be.
Yeah.
The white deer, they're losing their habitat. The other deer I have with the long, spindly legs, their land is sinking into the ocean.
Oh, God.
So I think a lot of them, what might make them feel more ethereal is that they don't have... they have no ground.
Yeah.
They have no place, but except for places in our hearts and our minds.
Mm-hmm. It's really pretty. And it's so sad, too. It's so true, but it's... I just love the fact that you can discuss, you know, really complicated subjects through the use of animal imagery and do a really good job of it. Because these are tough topics, man, and these are topics that people have heard a lot of, you know? And so it's like... getting people interested, keeping their interest, and getting them to actually, you know, instead of being like, oh, global warming, they'll like actually kind of like pay attention to it. It might make them think. Because, I mean, one of the things I've learned about doing this show now is that there's so many people that, you know, as soon as they hear what I do, they're like, oh, my God, I like animals so much more than people. And those... being able to start a dialogue with anyone regarding this, you know what I mean? But like that group of people, for example, where it can be like, oh my God, did you know, that the key deer are like dying and don't have a home anymore? And then it's like, oh my God, that's horrible. Where you could be like, you know, the Florida Keys are sinking into the sea. And it's like, oh, yawn, whatever. So it's funny how, you know, when an animal is in a situation, there are many, many cases that people react to it so much more. I think we've been so shut down on, like, human suffering at this point. But, you know, if there's a kitten stuck in a well, like, everyone goes nuts. And I think that's cool in a sense, you know?
Yes. Did you know one of my pieces was on the key deer?
Oh, you're kidding.
Did we talk about that?
Yeah, I think there may have been a quick mention once. I lived in Big Pine Key in Florida, which is home of the key deer. And it was pretty wild because it was like they weren't there. Like what I understood of it is, you know, back in the day, there were a lot of key deer. And they're these little tiny things. They're about the size of a German Shepherd in terms of height. They're adorable. They look. It's just like, oh, my God, there's baby deer everywhere. And it's like, no, those are the parents. The babies are about the size of like a, I don't even know, like a Jack Russell, a little bit taller than that. And Flagler, who is this man who did everything in Florida, basically decided he wanted to repopulate. And so he brought these guys in, and they brought them to Big Pine Key, I think. But anyway, they settled there. So I'm living on this island, which there ain't, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. There's not a lot there, but it's gorgeous. And there's all these little deer, and they're so cute. And then all of a sudden, I'm there for about a week. I'm there for a month. And then the police blotters come out, and more people are killing these deer, and they're finding all these wounded deer everywhere. It's horrible. And it's because, you know, well, they get into the garbage. And it's like, well, can you make a garbage receptacle where the deer aren't going to get into instead of abusing and killing them for this? It's like they're trying to survive. And by the time I left, it was all like big signs everywhere, like, don't feed the deer. Don't say hello to the deer. Don't talk to the deer. Don't be nice to the deer. You know, this whole thing. And it was like, it was just sad because it was like, you know, these deer were here. They disappeared. Everyone's like, gee, I wonder why they disappeared. And then all of a sudden they bring them back and they all disappear again for probably the same effing reason of why they died out 40, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, whenever it was. You know, and so that always really affected me because they're these little tiny deer. They're like harmless, you know. They're
right.
Totally cool. They swim in the ocean once in a while, which is also incredibly freaky. But they're just these little guys. And it's like, you know, the fact that people get such visceral reactions that they actually, I'm not sure what the law is at this point, but there was some kid who did something horrible to one of them, and he was actually jailed when I was down there. And so it's like, you know, the beginning of like trying to have repercussions for animal abuse. But those deer are just like, there's a lot to them.
They are back on the endangered.
No, they're not.
Officially.
Are you kidding?
And last week, someone actually nabbed three of them.
Oh, God.
And they put one male in the trunk and two in the back seat of the car.
Jesus.
And I think they get pulled over by a trooper or something for a taillight. But yes, they were kidnapping the Tiki deer. I'm like, these little critters, they have... Odds are stacked against them already. They don't need to be kidnapped.
I mean, it's like, what in the hell? People were trying to make them pets when I was down there. There was a couple families near me that, granted, were probably down there way too long and just had too much island fever and sunstroke. But we're like, they're so cute. We want to make them pets. And then we're going to start a farm. And then we're going to sell them to people. We're going to be rich. And it's like, these are wild animals. They are not domesticated. You cannot rip something out of the wild and be like, here's your new home. Welcome to my living room. Yeah, it was like, it was really, really interesting. It was really interesting to see that. And at that
point,
humans
think they can domesticate something and make money from it. They certainly will.
It's so sad, though. You know, it's like, it's absolutely fascinating to me. But what I also want to talk about, because I think that I love the fact that you do this, and especially through your art as well, that you have an organization called Project Thorn. And so I want to talk about that a little bit and find out how's it been going?
It's been going well.
Good.
And for those of you that Project Thorn is new to, I was thankfully interviewed on Animal Instinct about a year and a half ago to talk about the project as a whole. But Thorn stands for the tangible help our rhinos need. And it came about because I was making my artwork and exploring topics about poaching and animal welfare and all of these things. And the rhino is on the verge of, they're endangered, certainly, but there are only 20,000 of them left on the planet.
Wow.
And I was talking about this in my artwork, but I kind of felt that I was only talking to the already converted.
Mm.
I was talking to people that knew about rhinos or had consciousness about the poaching epidemic, maybe not specifically rhinos, but they'd already kind of been like, they were on board.
Yeah.
Like, this shouldn't be happening. We shouldn't be killing rhinos so that we can grind it up, their horn up, and put it in tea.
Seriously.
Maybe cure our cancer, which, of course, it doesn't work. It's keratin. It's what your fingernails are.
Yeah.
So I found that with my artwork, I was only reaching a certain audience, and I wasn't having any impact beyond that.
Mm.
So that's how Project Thorn came to be. I wanted to reach out in a way that was more tangible,
mm-hmm.
that could have a direct impact. And the first project that we sponsored was to conduct an educational and art program,
mm-hmm.
in 8 schools in South Africa.
Cool.
It was called the program's still going. It's called Project Rhino Art.
Oh.
Yeah, so it goes out to all the schools that surround the reserves. And many of the school children, even though they're like 5 kilometers from these rhinos, only like 5% of them had ever seen a rhino.
Wow.
And how do you learn to care about something you have no frame of reference for?
That's a good point.
If you've never seen one, the only thing you know about them is when someone in your village kills one and suddenly they have a new car.
Mm-hmm.
Or they suddenly move into a bigger house.
Yeah.
Or so that's the association a lot of people in the communities around the parks that have never actually seen the animals have with the animals. So the Rhino Art Project is to just bring more knowledge, try to get the kids to associate with the rhinos, understand how they contribute to their culture, mm-hmm. not just financially, but how it's part of their heritage.
Yeah.
So that was the first project. The second project is kind of underway as we speak, which I'm really excited about. But that was to reinstate a historic anti-poaching horse patrol.
Oh, cool.
To go out into areas of the park that the rangers were only able to patrol on foot due to the terrain mm-hmm. being so rugged and the distances so long. So large areas of parks just go unpatrolled, and that's typically where poaching occurs.
Yeah.
Of course, you go where the you're not going to get caught.
Totally.
So the horses actually open up the range a lot that the anti-poaching rangers can cover.
Cool.
With all projects, it's taken way longer to accomplish than I had hoped.
Yeah.
I was thinking just raising the funds for the program would be the biggest battle. But I've been working with 2 NGOs in South Africa called 12 Hours and Project Rhino KZN.
Uh-huh.
Both great, great organizations.
Cool.
Yeah, they've done everything from cut through the red tape of working with the Sands Park to finding a vet that will come and give the horses their shot.
Wow.
And trim a farrier to trim their hooves.
Wow.
And they've bought my saddles.
So oh, my
they've
God.
They've been great. The horses needed significant training,
mm-hmm.
Which has also taken some time, because a horse, as you know, you've had horses.
Yeah.
They can spook.
Yes. Yeah, so
put a leopard in the room with a horse or in
oh
the ring
God.
With a horse. The horses have to be spooked.
That's a good
so,
point.
So the horses have to be trained to be desensitized
wow.
to all the smells of being out in the bush.
Wow.
So all of that had to be put in place. So although it's taken longer than I had hoped, it's actually going to happen.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yay!
The groomsman is being trained right now.
Oh, my God.
At the stables with the horses.
Oh, my God.
And the horse trainer. And so they should be arriving in the near future.
That's really
exciting.
I'm
not going to say this week. The near future.
Totally, totally.
So that's going to be a big success. And we have them fully funded through the first year.
Awesome.
So all of their food, vet care, everything's paid for
God,
for 1 year.
Fantastic.
So I will likely try to raise more money to support the program.
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculously inexpensive as well.
Really?
I mean, probably for about $8,000,
mm-hmm.
I would be able to sustain these horses for a year.
Wow.
5 horses
What?
Year.
Are you kidding?
Yeah,
wow.
Can you believe it?
This should have ridden in Africa, my God. Wow.
Yeah, when you think of what you pay for stable fees for a horse.
Yeah, forget it.
Here, that's just to put a roof over your horse. We repaired stables and built paddocks.
Wow.
I'm proud of the project, and I'm just really eager to get those first photos of the rangers riding out into the bush.
That's so exciting. That's so exciting. And, yeah, for anybody that wants to know more about Project Rhino, we did an episode just specifically on this topic probably about a year ago, I think. And so there are more details on that episode if you'd like to hear more about this, because it's really pretty fascinating. And actually, a year ago, you were just looking into getting those horses. So I'm so excited for you. This is fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a little under a year ago that I finally got all the funds together and transferred them.
Amazing.
So Soon. I can't wait.
So here's the artist fantasy question. This is always the one that everyone goes, oh, God, I have no idea. Let's say you could do a massive installation. You got as much time as you need. You got as much money as you need. You got enough equipment to get this done and assistance. Oh, my God. And a budget. What do you think?
It's a dream world.
I know. It's a fantasy.
I have never worked with no budget, endless space, endless help. Oh, gosh, what would one do?
Right.
Having never worked without parameters, that would be quite a challenge. I think, though, thematically, to continue my animal work, mm-hmm. I would likely start speculating how animals could self-adapt.
Nice.
To exist in our changing world.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, like my key deer would have been my first experiment into this.
Cool.
And they grew long, stilted legs.
Oh, my God, I love
that
it.
That looks like kelp.
Cool.
So that their torsos and heads could be above water, but they could move through their marshlands.
Mm-hmm.
So I might continue with that work and create my futuristic ark filled
cool.
with animals that have found a way to exist on our planet.
You know, there's a scary thought I've never thought about before. With the water levels rising, I wonder if, like, we're all going to go back to the sea now. It's like we spent so much time getting out of that water, and now it's like, whoop, fin time, on again, you know?
Well, I really hope the polar bears learn how to grow gills really
quickly. Oh, Jesus,
quickly.
No kidding, right? I mean, I think
yeah.
we should start a nonprofit.
That would be the first one on my list.
That's actually amazing.
let's let those guys breathe underwater.
It's like, I feel like there needs to be a nonprofit that, like, makes islands and floaties for polar bears. It's just like, it's a crazy time we're living in, and I'm so grateful that there are people like you that have the guts and the chutzpah to talk about this and to show it in different methods and reach different communities than just, you know, I mean, I could sit, you know, on this radio show all the time and just be like, don't kill this, don't save the planet, blah, 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 blah. You know what I mean? And it's like, we need all different forms of media and all different forms of communication in order to really get people to listen. And I'm just, I mean, I've always loved your work, Carrie, but where you're going now, I just think is so cool. And
Thank you.
I really do. Your work is beautiful. It's impeccable. It always has been. You've always been the neatest and cleanest artist of anybody that I knew. That's for damn sure. And I just love the way that you think.
It's that designer in me.
I know, right? It's like, once you go graphic design, you can't be a slob. It's kind of like, oh, God, no, clean that up. But, yeah, I mean, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a joy to talk to you yet again.
Oh, anytime, girl. And so for people that are listening, where can they find your work and where can they find Project Thorn?
Project Thorn is at projectthorn.com. And we also have a generosity site if anybody feels compelled to help sponsor a horse.
Cool.
You just go into generosity and search for rhinos and horses.
Nice.
My personal work is at carriehuffy.com. And locally, actually, I just remembered, I have work at the Red Fox Art Gallery in Bedford right
now. Oh, cool.
It's not my animal work, but I'll be switching some things out with them.
Nice.
So maybe I'll send an animal that way.
Let me know if you do, and we'll put it on the website and get some other people out, because I know there are going to be people hearing this that want to see what you do.
Yeah. And right now, if you're in San Francisco, I have a piece at Root Division, which is a nonprofit space. And in the fall, I'll have an solo exhibition, and that will be all animal work.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I'm just pulling the pieces together now and
wow.
mapping them out in the space. But that's going to be at Los Mendonlos College in Pittsburgh.
Cool. Well,
yeah,
if you need an assistant, girl, you know where I am. I miss sculpture.
Yeah, well, get back to it.
I know. It's like one of the things, this is the thing about being an artist that people don't know, is that being an artist, it's a lot of fun, but wow, it's a hell of a lot of work. Office jobs are a lot easier than this, man. But it's in our blood. It's what we have to do.
It's also really fulfilling.
Yeah, it is, and we're the ones that need to tell the truth.
You're expressing yourself with your radio programs. You're still out there.
I'm trying.
Even if you're not physically making the things, you're still there. You're still performing.
Thanks, girl. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yay.
We need visual poets. We need writers. We need people that market the arts and You're doing it.
I'm trying my best. We're all getting there, Dawn. It's more honesty and the more reality we can get, the better off we're all going to be.
Isn't that the truth?
Right. So, for everybody listening, Carrie, thank you again.
Thank you.
Be in touch, everybody else. I will be back next week. In 2 weeks, I got two episodes back-to-back starring Ada Neves, who is amazing. She's a costume designer for dogs. She's one of the first wardrobe animal people. Super fun, super funny. So she'll be taking care of the show for me so I can go away for 2 weeks. And after that, then we're going to have a little break for the summer. And then the whole new season of Animal Instinct coming up in, yikes, I think September. I haven't seen the schedule yet. Anyway, thanks for listening. If you want to find me, you can find me on Instagram, Animal Instinct Radio, also Brooklyn Celia. Facebook is Animal Instinct. You can find it by putting in Animal Instinct 73. And on Twitter, I am at Food Healer. So until next week, I hope you have a good one and take care.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.